Welcome to Iron and Ceremony, Librarius Omnis, where we explore the depths of the Black Library.
I got it.
Okay. Do you want me to kick off?
Yeah, go for it, mate.
Hello, and welcome to the next edition of Mechanicum during the series of Iron and Ceramite Librarius Omnis. This is before I get into that, I'm joined by John. And we are now up to part
five.
I was going to say, I think it is part five.
Yeah.
Part five of this book, which we originally thought.
No.
As we do with most books, we think, oh, it'll take us three parts. We're now up to part five.
I think this is part six, you know.
It may be part six.
Because we did.
May even go on to part seven. I think, actually, it was part six last time, because we were we'll get this down by part seven. May have gone on before. So, for those of you that have listened before, you'll know where we're at. For those that have listened after, come back to this. That's a very weird, warpy loophole, but that's okay. Nonetheless, if this is the first video you've watched of Iron and Ceramite Librarius Omnis, where we look after and read the Black Library, I recommend you go back, look before. If you're interested in other parts of the Black Library, go right the way back to several videos ago. But if you're just interested in Mechanicum, as I said, we may be in part five, this may be part six.
We've been doing it for years, it feels like.
Yeah, it's a deep book. There's lots of lore and there's lots of interesting parts. But you join us today, hopefully, at a critical part during the entire story. We've had lots and lots of background and lore, both from the Martian side of things, the priesthood, and how they are involved in the machine cult and the cult of the Emperor. And the Omnissiah, the different forges, how they interact, a lot of the politics of Mars, and then right up to where we are now, where there are several different factions, including the Knightly Orders. So for those that play the tabletop, those are your really big miniatures, take a lot of painting, a lot of detail. The Skitarii run around underneath. And then actually the Forge Masters that deal with it, right up to which is also a group of, I don't want to call them separatists, but they're a group of individuals that were employed under one of the Adepts of Mars, and they are on their own striking out to try and find the Noctis Labyrinthus, and they found themselves embroiled against an AI machine, a machine that has the abominable intelligence, not artificial intelligence, abominable intelligence, which I think we covered in the last video to some degree anyway.
Yeah.
And as we pick up today, war on Mars has really broken out. Obviously, we saw at the end of the last chapter that we talked about was that the Magma City was being defended by one of the Legios. And now we're effectively in full out war, as well as this subplot of Dahlia and her team as they try and uncover the mysteries of the Dragon of Mars.
It's chasing the dragon.
Indeed. I think that's a fair synopsis of where we're up to, John. I don't know if you want to add anything else to that.
No, I think that's it. I mean, like you've said already, if you don't know what we're talking about, then you need to go back and start from part one of this series. Otherwise, it's going to be very confusing. And we spent a lot of hours to sort of cram it all into the beginning of this video, I think. So I think that's a good summary of where we're at.
Yeah. I'll try and keep it short. But
yeah. Cool. So before we jump into it, obviously, as always, we've got our cast of characters. And I want to see if you can see the subtle fix that I have inserted.
I like that, because every time it threw me, but now it doesn't.
I know. We're right at the end and it doesn't matter anymore, but it's there.
It's good, though. It's good. Yeah. It's a good reminder.
Cool. So we are into part three of the book, Origins Mechanicus. So let's go into it. Chapter one. As we said, war has properly broken out now. The first blow in the War on Mars was felt by Magos Kefra. The Titan of Magna Legion smashed down the gates of his forge in and had his howling engines decorated in orange and red and black, adorned in spikes and skulls. So that's the new trend. Everyone's gone goth, gone for skulls, and now you know you're well and truly fucked. So these guys basically smash through the walls of his forge, and as we sort of mentioned before, like, it's just a case of if we can't have it, you can't have it. They come in and they smash all of the libraries, destroying thousands of years of knowledge, smashing up weapons factories, and this guy in particular supplied the Solar Guard. And basically they crushed every living thing that they could and just cleared this guy off the face of the map. The next person to suffer was High Magos Aotep. 100 missiles hit the crater where his vehicle yards were kept, resulted in an explosion that caused nuclear fire to just wipe him off the map. Again, like, just what's the point? I don't know. So no one's trying to capture anything. It's just destroying stuff. So then it was the Lunar Palace and Arcadia regions. They've been long contested for ownership between the Deathstalkers and the Deathbolts. Both great names, but who is the good guys with names like that? Who knows? Regardless, the Deathstalkers launched a surprise attack, taking out 19 of the Deathbolt's engines within an hour, forcing them into a retreat. Their calls for reinforcements unanswered as the whole planet was warring with itself. In the Athabasca Isles, Legio Ignamphum and the Burning Stars fought hand-to-hand through the valleys. Neither could take advantage and beat the other. A horde of twisted Skitarii attacked the forge of Ipulvan Maximal, but he was actually able to repel the first wave and keep his forge secure. But soon he was surrounded by twisted siege engines, keeping him trapped inside. The greatest loss of life was felt by Adept Ruan Vilnarius in his glacial forges when rockets containing mutated strains of Life Eater virus were set loose on him. Tens of thousands fell immediately in agonizing pain. Once airborne, it killed millions within the worker habs within 3 hours. Those who were quick enough to evacuate to vacuum sealed chambers were not protected as the warp mutated strain got through the protective casings. Within 7 hours, over 14 million corpses laid in a liquefying mess, slowly freezing where they fell.
Yeah.
Grim.
No fun at all.
No. The fighting was not confined to the surface. The Ring of Iron, the Halo space station that surrounded the Red Planet, shuddered as the forces loyal to Terra and the forces loyal to Horus laid waste to each other as ships of the Battlefleet Solar pulled away in horror, watching as the Mechanicum blasted itself out of space with no strategy or reason. Ships split open, spilling thousands into the vacuum of space as others crashed onto the planet's surface. The flaming wreckage of Mechanicum Glorium hurtled down towards the planet's surface. Here's a word. The Technophilegians watched its descent from the Basilica of the Blessed Algorithm. So try to say that 5 times fast. I dare
you. Well, you did a good job. I think that was a worthy effort.
Don't know what any of it means, but we got through it. So they took this as a sign of displeasure from the divine machine god and broadcast pleas for ceasefires across any channel they could access. However, this was cut short as the Mechanicum Glorium slammed into the Basilica and obliterated the temple complex, wiping out billions of faithful tech priests and ending any cries for reason and peace. All in all, the factions and forges of Mars turned on each other as if they'd been lifelong blood enemies, in their own spite, destroying their enemies' libraries, factories, and history. Technology upon mass was lost forever in blood and fire. So, war, like that's
war like comes
World
to
War
pass.
III, isn't it? Like worse than any world war we could imagine.
Yeah, well, that's what they say. At this point, although the subtext of the book is knowledge is power, obviously, if it's, you know, looking up, it's war comes to Mars.
Yeah.
And this is it. Like, the or this strange offshoot that has acted independently has come under, treaty with the Emperor. Mars has always been slightly different. It survived Old Night. It's always slightly separate. They've worshipped the Omnissiah. Some believe it, the Emperor, some not. These schisms are widened by the influence of Chaos.
Mm.
And we're seeing this alpha strike that's changing the face of Mars.
Mm. It's like, and they've just been waiting for an excuse to fight, really, haven't they? I'm sure it'll end well for somebody.
Maybe. I don't know, but maybe.
Anyway, well, while that's all going on, we'll jump back to Dahlia's group. They obviously survived the attack of the Kaban machine, and were able to salvage a cargo transport and carry on out through the tunnels and across the dusty planet away from war. So Severin had broken her arm and they'd bound it up, and she was staring at Dahlia in fear, wondering how she had managed to make the machine go away. Caxton suggested that it just missed them, but Severin was adamant that Dahlia had done it. And Dahlia admitted she wasn't sure herself. She'd been able to see inside the machine and saw how it operated. And the design of Lucas Crom was all over it. And she had been able to tell it what to do. Severin doesn't understand why an adept like Crom would want to kill her. And they assume it's because she created the Akashic Reader, giving Zeph, his enemy, knowledge that no one else has. And in turn, giving her power and knowledge that he wants. And she believes that whatever is buried in the Noctis Labyrinthius is key to making the reader work and could make them more powerful than any other adept. So naturally, they're all scared of losing this power, and Crom wants to stop them. So it'll take them quite a long time now to travel in this cramped transport across towards their destination, and they're going to have to skirt around the Forge of Crom, around Mondus Gamma. When they first emerged from the tunnel system and they caught the first glimpse of it, it spread as far as they could see, from south to east, and just looked like an oil slick on the horizon. One of the largest forges on Mars stretched out further than anyone could see and loomed menacingly in the distance, and making it feel much worse now that they knew that something lived there that was actively trying to hunt and kill them specifically. However, being open out in the open air and surviving that attack, their spirits were high as they began making good ground towards their destination. And after days of traveling in almost complete silence, the ground became visibly rockier until Romu slowed the crawler to a halt and pointed to a dark scar in the surface, which dropped sharply into the ground between two cliffs. They had arrived at the western entrance of the Noctis Labyrinthius. What now? Asked Severin. And Caxton told her, well, we're going in. We haven't come all this way just to turn back. And although Dahlia was terrified to go in the darkness, she was happy with Caxton stepping up and making the decision for her. Romu moved the crawler on slowly, descending beneath the planet's surface. And Dahlia felt uneasy, and as if they were entering an ancient and unhealed wound. So that's they finally got there to the entrance. All have survived the attack. I don't even know if at this point we know why Dahlia knows that she could see inside this machine. I think it's her sort of telepathic sort of
I think it's like one of those fake pieces. Like it's the same reason that she was able to see all of the various bits and pieces that have come before the Adeptus Mechanicus Wi-Fi that Adept Zeff was using. I can't remember the New Sphere. That's it.
Yeah, that's
it. The fact that she was able to see all of that, you know, all of that is just an indication of what she may or may not have in terms of powers.
Yeah.
But it's definitely the case that there's something unusual about her.
Yeah.
And she definitely has a power of the machine spirit, as they would say.
Yeah. So, so we'll obviously, we'll follow them. But hot on their heels, we've got Maven and Cronus in their knights, who have just arrived at the destroyed Maglev. Which
they're still chasing the, or one of them's following the
Kaban machine.
Yeah, they're following their Titan. Their Titan that's got the is it the Warhound that has the scent of it? That they're just like, no, I've got to follow this machine spirit because it needs its revenge.
Yeah, it's the Equitos Bellum Maven's Warhound. So they've literally, like, they're following the scent, and they've just arrived at the wreckage of the Maglev, and they're both absolutely furious because it's not just been destroyed. Like, they're looking at all the wreckage and bodies broken in the tunnel. Like, their job is obviously to protect people, and like, this is just an atrocity. And Maven turns to Cronus, who's obviously been quite skeptical up until now, and says to him, do you feel like we're still chasing ghosts? And Cronus admits that he had regretted following him when they began. And after they'd been hearing about the events unfolding across Mars and wanting to go and join their legion, they knew that now Maven was right, and he vows to help find and destroy whatever's done this. And Maven's obviously glad to hear it, but didn't mention to him that he actually felt the same and thought they'd been doing something wrong until they'd come across an almost completely buried wreckage of a prospector's hauler. And from there, the Bellum had pulled him eastwards towards the tunnel system, picking up the scent. The news of war breaking out had torn the two warriors, knowing that they needed to rejoin their order in the defence of the Magma City. But Honor also told them that they could not abandon their quest. They could only finish it. Maven could sense they were very close to catching this machine, and they agreed the sooner they found it, the sooner they could kill it and return to their family. So Romu carries on driving the cargo crawler deeper, and oddly, the further they went down, the colder it got, to the point where Romu had to divert some power from the heat to the heaters to avoid the glass frosting over so he could still see. Eventually, the slopes leveled out, and they were able to move at speed. And Dahlia directed Romu, even though she didn't really know where they were going. She was able to guide him. And they did this in silence, just with nods of heads and gestures, because they didn't want to make any noise that may make her lose her connection to whatever was guiding her. And the further they went, the more technical issues their ride suffered. Random spurts of static from the Vox, the chronometers all stopping at the same time, and the internal lights going out. The engine cut out several times, and Caxton had to go out in the darkness and coax it back to life. Several more days passed. When the engine cut out again, Caxton groaned and prepared to go out again, but Romu told him that he wouldn't need to. The battery was completely dead. And Severin asked what they were supposed to do now. She's full of good questions, isn't she? She's really helpful.
Very, very useful. Very useful.
Well. And Dahlia said, look, it's all right. And pointed out into the cavern they'd stopped in. And outside was a sheer cliff towering over them. Its surface was smooth like glass and shone with faint internal light. Several passageways were broken into the cliff, faced with strange steaming mist rising from their entrances. The breath of the dragon meant they had arrived. So now we're going to leave Terra... I've spoiled that.
Terra, yeah, I was going to say.
Now we're gonna leave Mars. We're gonna leave Mars and take a trip to Terra. So the crown of Terra, the hollowed out mountain of the Himalaya, encircled with the Himadari precinct, A towering warrior dressed in magnificent golden armor marched along the concourse of black glassy marble, lined with statues and honor banners, past stained glass windows larger than warlord titans. The warrior paced alongside a smaller white-haired man in simple administrator robes. The companion was as unremarkable as the warrior was exceptional. Behind this duo marched a detachment of 10 custodian warriors in bronze armor, although they were purely ceremonial, as Rogal Dorn, Primarch of the Imperial Fists, required no protection. Do you want to cover off on this part?
it's good that, I think for those that read the books up to this point, it's kind of a bit of a change, because we went from, I mean, early on, very Astartes heavy, to where we are now, and the Mechanicum is definitely not that. And then suddenly we're presented with Astartes on Terra.
Mm-hmm.
And we've not really had any approach to that. And it's suddenly like, oh, you know, we're on Earth, because up until now it's been very Space Crusade.
Yeah.
To use the name of one of the board games that's all named after, but very Space Crusade, very away from Earth, very away from our solar system. And then suddenly we've got Rogal Dorn, who's on Terra, who's there to build the defenses, and suddenly we're very much involved in what could be happening. And at this point, also on Terra, they're quite confused. They don't know what's happening. They know, like the Mechanicum, there's a lot of chat about Horus, and at this point, probably not atrocities, but certainly, weird things going on, like happening in the Isfahan system. So it's a very strange sort of setup, and you've got, an introduction to Dorn, one of the first in the series, because I don't think we've come across Dorn yet.
Well, we came across him in Flight of Eisenstein, didn't we?
Oh, we did.
When he bumped into Nathaniel Garrow. So
we passed
that when he left him on the moon.
For the second time, we bumped into Dorn. And again, at this point, it is very much like they're feeling their way.
Yeah. Well, Dorn's still getting over what he's been told as well, because he's just been told by a random captain of another legion that the best of them has turned traitor and is killing everybody.
It's all potentially coming together, right? He's got this uprising out in Isfahan, and he's got, suddenly there's a civil war on Mars. He doesn't know whether it's related, and obviously on Mars, as it was at the time, a huge forge world that was supplying all of the arms, ammunition that was required. So Dorn has to make a decision, and Malkador is as a council is there to help him. But also, you know, in the spirit of conversation, unveils very interesting conversation to do with, the other Space Marine legions.
Mm.
And, it's a real key bit of lore for anyone. It's a real lore head in terms of the Lost Legions, because it's the first time it's really mentioned in the Heresy.
Yeah, because they're basically looking at the fortification that they've got, and Malkador sees Dorn's just looking so distraught or sad anyway, and he says, "Well, what's going through your mind?" And he says, "I'm just wondering how long it would take me to take down this ceremonial building and turn it into a fortification. But obviously, if we had to do it, then we'd have." And Horus's forces make it this far, we would have already lost. And they're sort of worried that they're feeling alone because of they've all been turned on, and we don't know where the Emperor is. We know where he is. He's down in his vaults, and he's not coming out to help. And Malkador says, "No, he's given you the tools. Like, you can deal with it. Whatever he's doing is more important. Just have to trust him on this. Look, Horus has got 3 other legions as well as his own. And Dorne, you have the Imperial Fists and 13 others. And Dorne says, would that it was 15.
Yes.
And Malkador warns him, do not even think it, my friend. They are lost to us forever.
And I thought he had his mind wiped. Maybe it's the other, maybe it's just the Space Marines that joined the Ultramarines that had their mind wiped. But that's it. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a point of lore contention.
I mean, yeah, because is that going to be something that comes up later? Because it's not really been covered. We've not covered it at all yet, have we?
I don't know. All I know is that the main theory is that the reason the Ultramarines chapter for Legion grew in size so quickly was because the 2 fallen legionnaires were pushed into the Ultramarines.
Yeah.
Not confirmed. No, again, one of the joys of the lore. Games Workshop definitely don't need to confirm it. And why would they?
No.
But that's it. The Marines that were part of the fallen legions were pushed into the Ultramarines. That's why their ranks swelled so much. And that's it.
Yeah. He may have had his mind wiped a bit, but they, I don't know, because they must have known. Oh, maybe. Yeah.
Maybe they just remember their brothers. I don't know. It's weird because it's going to take a lot to get into it. This is not for now. This is for other discussions. But there's lots of lore and lots of different theories about the 2 lost. Obviously, originally, like if we go from lore to tabletop, they were there merely to allow you to create your own chapter.
Yeah.
But since then, the lore and the stories have risen around it. So it's a lot more than that now.
Maybe we'll pick it up as we go through this series. But for now, I think we'll leave the speculation. We'll carry on.
Wild speculation.
So Dorne, he knows, looking at the numbers, Horus stands very little chance, but he's very concerned because Horus has always been the one who could find a way to do things when others could not. And the fact that he doesn't actually know what he's afraid of is what is causing the most concern for Dorne at the moment. Malkador waves his hand toward a black portal at the end of the precinct. It's their destination, and perhaps the master of the Astro Telepathica will be able to give them news of the legions. Dorne is hopeful. After all the sacrifices he made to break the warp, he wants good news of Sanguinius and the Lion. And of Gilliman and Russ offers Malkador, but Dorne isn't worried about those two. They can handle themselves. But the others were heading directly towards danger the last time he'd heard of them. He was grieved that he couldn't reach them and prepare the defences of Terror at the same time and attack the traitors too. And Malkador asked if he still intended to fight Horus himself. And Dorne said that he must pay after the events of Istvan. Malkador agreed, but said that they have problems closer to home. The uprising of Mars is the main one. Malkador had received news of war on Mars from Maximal. The only news that from the Fabricator General had made no sense, and he feared that they'd been turned on. Dorne asked how trustworthy Maximal was, and Malkador shrugged, basically said, I don't know. Maximal was prone to exaggeration, but he's definitely loyal to the Emperor. So on this occasion, we have to believe the rebellion is true. So Dorne states that he will send Sigismund and 4 companies of Imperial Fists to Mars. Mondus Gamma and Mondus Oculum provide the bulk of supplies required by Astartes, so they will strike there, capture them, and then push out to secure others. And Malkador raises an eyebrow at Sigismund's name, asking if he's too volatile for this task. And Dorne agrees, but suggests that he's the man to get the job done, but he's going to send Camber Diaz with him, who will provide a steadying influence. Dorne says that he will also take regiments of the Imperial Army to bulk out his forces because they are stationed nearby on the moons of Saturn and Jupiter. Malkador suggests that he also take Saw Talgron's word bearers, and Dorne says no to this. He needs them for the assault on Istvan IV. With that, Malkador agrees and gives the order for him to secure the forges of Mars and then push out to destroy the traitors on Istvan. And if they fail, the last 300 years have been for nothing. And that's the end of chapter one. So, Sigismund, big name.
It's good seeing him, right? It's good hearing it. I like the fact they call him out, like, you know, it, Sigismund, but also they call him out for being a bit impetuous, maybe a bit too zeal-hearty. Yeah. I think that's nice. I think that makes a lot of sense. And that they send someone else with him. And actually, when, well, we'll see. But when the story goes on, it's good to see how that develops. Also, it's really nice to see a bit of interplay between Malkador and one of the Primarchs.
Mm.
Because there's a lot of respect there. And there's also a lot of discussion. Even though Malkador is not transhuman.
Mm.
And the Primarchs are. And I think that comes across later as well in other stories. So I think that's interesting as well. It's nice to kind of flow away from Mars very quickly to kind of place it in the global universal conflict that's happening. And kind of overview the entire piece. And actually the Dahlia storyline, although, you know, it's very small in terms of where it's happening. And right now feels small, but it's going to become more important as it comes on.
Yeah.
And actually also as I said, the Sigismund impact is going to be important as well for the loyalist effort on Terra, which we are many, many books away from. But it's good to know this is where it starts.
Yeah. And then also mention of Saw Talgron and the Word Bearers getting
left out. And that's one that, again, third time now reading it, flick by it. I was like, oh, yeah, of course. They're not good dudes. Why are they involved?
Yeah.
They're probably good.
Yeah, but no one knows about Battle of the Abyss yet, do they?
They don't know they've turned. So it's like whether it's like weird luck or just manipulation that they've not been involved.
So I'm just trying to think now, because obviously they're saying you've got Horus and three other legions. So the other three legions that we know have turned are the Emperor's Children, the Death Guard, and the World Eaters.
World Eaters, yeah. So
And obviously so now the Sons of Horus, as they are. And then we know that the Word Bearers have turned and have a couple of others.
Word Bearers, Iron Hands? No, not Iron Hands. The other one. Iron Warriors.
Iron Warriors.
And Night Lords. And Alpha Legion.
And that's the thing, is it? So they think Horus has got four legions on his side, but it's actually a bit more equal with seven.
Yeah. It's very equal,
So that's good. So we know where we stand now in the wider scheme of things, and what some people don't know that we do know. So let's move into chapter two, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to go back to Adept Zeph. As she'd feared, the forces of the Fabricator General had returned and in greater number, like Tusken Raiders. Alarms had been raised, and it was clear that Legio Mortis was on the march. Led by the Imperator Titan, a mix of warlords, reavers, and four warhounds made up a band of 13 engines, which had taken to the western flank and destroyed a vital supply line to the Magma City. And it was slowly making its way through a breach caused by the guns of the gigantic engine they'd brought with them. Armour of red, silver and black made its way through the container yards towards the worker habs, home to hundreds of thousands, all freshly painted with the eye of Horus, spitting out scrap code which could be heard below the bellowing war horns. The engines couldn't march along the heavily defended Typhus causeway, so merely used their guns to blast through a path through the habs instead. The engines ignored the fleeing civilians, knowing that the twisted Skatari warriors would cleanse them on their way. In defence, the Magma City fired artillery at the ground of the habs where the enemy marched, obliterating most of the first wave of foot soldiers, but the destruction was nothing compared to the hordes still to come. The four warhounds bounded ahead of the rest, and one was downed after a direct hit took out one of its legs, causing it to fall face down, grind along the ground for about 30 metres before coming to a stop. Before the defenders could celebrate the achievement, too much enemy fire came back tenfold, tearing through a chunk of the defence and igniting ammo caches along the defending wall. Again, the defenders' moment of joy obliterated instantly, mainly because they were blown up and not there to celebrate. As the survivors fled the fortifications, a crew of hundreds wheeled out an ordinatus machine, rolling it forward on heavy gauged railings, an absolutely huge piece of artillery needing its own power generators just to operate. So through the wreckage of the wall that was there, they brought out a massive cannon, basically. The crew locked in a firing solution onto one of the Reaver Titans that strayed away from the main pack, firing a searing beam of blinding, unwavering energy from the artillery piece, hitting the lone Reaver directly in the face, smashing through its shields, causing a froth of discharge energy to blow outward, vaporizing hundreds of mutated Skatari warriors. The Ordinatus machine continued to hammer the Reaver, causing fires to erupt inside, breaching the reactor core, the resulting explosion sending molten shrapnel all over the place. Its brothers suffered momentarily as the scrap code it emitted wailed as the machine died. The Ordinatus then began to roll back into the bunker in order to recharge. However, the Aquila Ignis fired its annihilator cannon, scoring a direct hit of the Ordinatus cannon, and it vanished in a cloud of nuclear plasma. The defenders were all distracted by the horrific loss and froze for a moment, allowing the warhounds to dart forward and smash through the last defensive lines. The warhounds unleashed their fury and shredded the tiny forms fleeing before them. They worked together, leveling buildings and wiping out survivors as they cleared a path for their larger brothers. One warhound became separated, and the others was suddenly alerted to its death cry. As they rushed through the wreckage, they found its smouldering remains and immediately began scanning for the culprit. The lead warhound caught a life sign and fired all its power through Steelworks Factory, hoping to cause its prey to flee into the open. But as the building collapsed, it was surprised as the hulking monster in bright blue armour stepped through the fire, its warhorn blaring. The Deus Tempestus smashed into the warhound, knocking it over and stamping down it with a gigantic foot, crushing it like a tin can. Engine kill, declared Princess Cavallario.
I got very sucked into that moment.
Hey, do you know what? When I was reading it,
I was like, you're reading it, and I'm like, oh my God, amazing.
It's like we've been waiting for these Titans to go for it. Like, we've seen little bits of Titans doing what they do in a couple of books now, but I think probably the best we got was in Legion as well. But this is just like engines on engines. Like, I mean, it's great, isn't it? On a massive scale as well.
I said, I was just sitting here listening as you're getting into it, and I'm like, oh, there we go. This is it. This is where it's going to happen. We're in.
Imagine seeing that, like a collapsing building and this fucking Power Ranger megabot smashing through.
Yeah, grim dark Power Ranger.
Yeah, it's just gonna be absolutely to get like that in a good animation would be brilliant. Or even, I mean, they're never gonna, do it better than Transformers did it.
Oh, absolutely. As I said, it's a moment. the grim dark element is the bit that most animation, most bits of it, like, you know, you've got Transformers, you've got anime, you've got Gundam, you know, you've got Power Rangers. None of it is going to do it in the epic scale that we're talking about, or the way it's written. And that, you know, that's one of the reasons why I love reading it, right? Because exactly. It's not quite, it's never going to get there through any other means other than written form and imagination.
Yeah. I remember, like, reading this the second time for this, and I was like, even coming to the end of part two, I was like, I'm sure we get Titan fights. Where are they?
Yeah.
And when I was reading this, I read it a couple of times, because I read a bit, take some notes, read a bit, take it. I just read it, and I was like, oh, I didn't write anything down. So, yeah, so, no, it's
this good. Is the bit.
I mean, I definitely, like we've said in a couple of the books now, like, this is definitely a scene to go and check out.
Yeah.
If you enjoy reading and stuff, go and check this out.
Yeah, definitely worth reading once and then reading again, because the details really, really well done.
Yeah. We've got Tempestus in the fight now. I was right.
We've got Tyrannus. Now Tempestus is in the fight.
They're all in the fight. They've got one Warhound left from Mortis. Seeing its brothers killed, it turns to flee, retreating towards the Reavers, but it was caught in a deadly crossfire of two ambushing Titans, ending it in a ball of flame. The Stormlord surveyed the battlefield as a number of engines lined up ready to defend the Magma City. If Mortis wants a fight, we will ensure they get one. So Zephyr's obviously petitioned for all the help she could get, and she's been really lucky. She's got her Legio Tempestus of actual engines, and then the Knights of Tyrannus. So she's got two Legios
and rocked up.
Yeah, to defend her. And then you've got old Maximal just sat off on his own. It maybe was too far for him to get to.
I don't know if he was done. Well, I mean, you know, whether they looked at it strategically and went, there's nothing we can do about it, so we'll leave him alone.
Yeah.
It is nice. The Magma City feels more fitting than whatever Pluvial's got going on.
Yeah, I forget what his is called.
I mean, it's nowhere near as cool.
No. So she's got some good defence going on here, and she's watching the battle from a little HQ inside, watching it on pick screens and dissecting the incoming data. Four enemy Warhounds and a Reaver destroyed was good news to receive, but the engines of Legio Tempestus were still heavily outnumbered by those of Mortis. Even with the Stormlord in his new god machine, they were outmatched by Tempestus. But Tempestus knew this and had shown up regardless. They had already lost three knights in defense of the Vulcan Gate. She regretted the loss of the Ordinus cannon, but knew it was needed trap to lure the Warhounds forward. And she had to stand and watch helplessly as her territory and factorums were being demolished all around her. She'd been in constant comms with Maximal and Kane via her pick screens, and they were all witnessing the loss of thousands of years of technology and knowledge together. Kane told them that Dawn was sending forces to Mars to fight the enemy, and they needed to hold them off until they could arrive. And Zeph asked what else he had been told, because she knew that Tempestus and Tyrannus couldn't hold on for long, and Maximal demanded to know too, as he was suffering daily attacks and was struggling to repel each attack. Kane told them that the Imperial Army and the Saturn regiments had been tasked to assist in the relief of both of their forges, whilst the Astartes would evacuate Kane's forge. Captain Sigismund will make planetfall at Kane's forge, whilst Captain Camber Diaz will assault Lucas Kroms. Maximal didn't want to hear that, because now he knows the Astartes weren't coming to help him. All they were going to do is secure the supply lines from Kane's forge, leaving him in the lurch. And Kane tells them that Sigismund has stated that once he's secured the supplies, he will assist Zeph and Maximal. And with that, Kane ended his call. Maximal hung around and asked if Seth had heard anything from Dahlia, and she told him that Romu had stopped transmitting biometrics some time ago, and she feared they were already dead. But they're not dead, because the tunnels had not been as dark as Dahlia had expected.
There's still a lot going on before that even starts, right? Like, there's, the whole geopolitical piece between Astartes rocking up, who are we going to help? As we know, the Astartes are not a global...
They're not sentimental.
There's not enough of them. They're not sentimental, but they're also... There's not enough of them to do stuff. They are there for incisive strikes to, change the balance and then get out.
Yeah.
In this instance, they're not going to change the balance. So they're like, we're going to get all of the ammo and armor we can and then get out.
Yeah. It's land, fill your arms up and run.
Yeah. And that's rough for the loyal Mechanicum. Because they're like, they're not protecting us. But then that is unfortunately the Astartes all over throughout the period, and that's going to go on because there's not enough of them to actually fight long wars. They are there to, strike in, convert, get out.
Yeah. And that just shows as well, the amount of stock you could put into the solar defences and the Imperial Guard. Like, they said, don't worry, we're sending regiments to come and sort you out. And it's not good enough. Like, they know that they're just going to get ground up.
Yeah, I mean, into the meat grinder.
Yeah.
There's nothing there that it's going to help them help.
No. Oh. So, loyalty is not paying off at the minute.
However, there is also the... as well as the Astartes that are coming in, they also need to factor into what Dahlia is up to.
Yeah. Does Zeph actually know?
No.
Zeph
doesn't know, because when she says Romu 31 has not transmitted anything back, she genuinely doesn't know, because... if I remember correctly, they're at a point where they're at the Noctis Labyrinth where it's all going to go dark anyway.
So I know, obviously, she thinks they're dead. He stopped transmission. She thinks they're dead. I'm just trying to remember if we said, because she obviously let them leave the Magma City.
Oh, yeah.
Because she thinks that she does think they're looking for something for the Akashic Reader, doesn't she? What she thinks is going on.
She's going to find truth. I think that's the thing, is that she doesn't believe that there is an emperor or an omnissiah. Like, that she is very much imperial truth to the point of total pragmatism.
Yeah.
That's the thing with the Mechanicum. So they believe in the omnissiah, which ultimately the emperor is okay with, because they see him as the omnissiah. So he's like, right, as long as I'm the pragmatic truth, I'll let them believe in me. Ultimately, the emperor never wanted to be believed in anyway, because that makes him a god, and that's not where he wanted. He wanted the imperial truth. Very quick sentence there. He wanted the imperial truth, which was very non-secular, and that would mean that the Martians were also non-secular, which would also mean the Omnissiah is against that.
Yeah.
It's only because of the brokered deal that he had. So there's a lot here that breaks the Imperial Truth, the Omnissiah, and the deal between Terra and Mars, which is why the Dragon of Mars is so crucial.
Yeah. We need to figure it out.
Bit of a tangent there, went into it a bit.
No, but okay, cool. So let's crack back on with Dahlia. As I said, so tunnels had not been as dark as she expected. The rock itself glowed with some form of bio-illumination. However, it was much colder than expected, and the tunnels were so narrow they had to walk in single file as they sloped ever downwards. Although it was cold, the walls were warm to the touch, and although they looked smooth, they had a bumpy texture. And she asked what could have caused the tunnels to form this way. Zuch suggests a natural geological metamorphosis, something from eons of heat and pressure passing through. But Dahlia suddenly had a thought that maybe something is buried here, trying to reach outwards. As they went further, the light faded and they had to rely on Romu's light until suddenly he stopped and told them to listen. They paused and in the distance they heard the faint sound of movement. Caxton asked what it was and Romu said he didn't know. He didn't think anything was down here. And Dahlia made them keep going until they emerged into a wide laboratory chamber carved out into the rocks. One wall was covered in thousands of colourful sheets of parchment. At the far end of that wall was a darkened passageway. There was a surgical table against another wall surrounded by a bank of respirators, drips and other odd machinery next to what appeared to be a large rock drill. At the tip of the device were four spokes, each with a small emitter dish attached to them. The dishes were pointed at a large slab on the far wall with the imprinted shadow of a human body with leather straps where the wrists and ankles would be. Now, this can't be good, said Caxton. And Dahlia ignored him, went over to the parchment wall, and Severin pulled one down. Each piece had a human silhouette on it, surrounded in a variety of colours, but each parchment was the same. And on each, the colour faded around an arm or a leg, as if the machine creating it ran out of power during the process. Zuch was examining the machine, not liking it and worrying that it was some sort of dark, forgotten tech. Caxton laughed as he walked in front of the machine, saying, "You don't even know what it does. How can you be scared?" And Dahlia shouted at him to get away from the front of it. He told her to calm down. It doesn't look like it's been used in centuries. There's nothing to worry about. Severin laughed at him, reminded him that the last time he'd said that, a killer robot had attacked them. And Zuch, who'd been examining the machine, said, "There isn't a touch of rust on it. I think someone had used it recently." And then a cracked voice, ancient and thick, said, "And you would be right." They all turned in surprise, and Romu readied his weapon as an adept came out of the dark passage. The adept continued, "Oh, yes, you are right. Oh, happy day you came to me. I'd almost given up on anyone ever arriving." "Who are you?" demanded Romu, igniting his stave as a hulking servitor moved out behind the adept, one arm replaced with a chain blade and the other with a power claw. The adept pulled his hood back, revealing a gaunt face with thin strips of white hair and flesh that shone with an eerie light. And on his forehead was a tattoo of a spiral with a set of wings either side. Dahlia realized this was the mark of the dragon. "I dreamed of you," said Dahlia. "The hooded man is real," asked Caxton, causing the adept to say, "I am as real as any of you, or what constitutes real in this cesspool of a universe is up for debate." "Who are you?" demanded Romu again. "Now there's a question one might ask. How many stars are there? It's been so long since I saw them. Are they still there?" he asked. Dahlia said, "What do you mean, the stars?" And "I don't know, there could be millions." And he laughed at her, saying, "You either don't know, but then you say there are millions. So which one is it?" Romu stepped towards the adept again, demanding that he tells them the name. And the adept said, "It's hard to remember. It's been so long. My name is meaningless, but men once called me Semyon." "What are you doing here?" asked Dahlia. And Semyon span around, telling her that words like here and there had no meaning. There are so many dimensions that human language can't define them all. He stared at her with fire in his eyes, the same fire she had seen seconds before Jonas Marlis died. "I am the guardian of the dragon," he finished. So, new character.
He is the knight at the end of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. When Indiana gets through all of the temple traps, and he's there, and he's got to pick a grail. And there's a Knight Templar, that's one for Dave. Mm-hmm. There's a Knight Templar waiting there and saying, "You've got to pick from the cup of Christ.
Which one do you pick? Yes, is this all been leading up to?
It's exactly the same. It's entirely the same. There's no difference. Like, literally, there's no difference. The only difference, and the spoiler alert, is that whereas in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, they lose the Grail and ride off, and the Nazis fail. In this instance, they stay. I'm not saying the Nazis stay, but what it is they pick the right cup, and they actually stay in the circle. Those that have seen the film, they stay in the circle, so the temple doesn't crumple. Effectively, there is a new Knight Templar to look after the Grail for a longer period of time. In this instance, the Grail is the dragon.
Yeah. So we're not
amounts of spoilers there for both this story and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. If you've not seen it,
if you've not seen Indiana Jones, I think you could avoid spoilers. It's been long enough.
So I've got no time for you if you've not seen. Forget you. No, done.
So we know that the final scene now is just going to be some guy moving a big box through a massive factory, a big warehouse.
That's it. Well, the very, very, very end. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then maybe jumping in a fridge and surviving a nuclear blast. No.
Forget that one.
Too far.
There's only three.
I agree.
It's like Die Hard, isn't it? There's only three.
There's only so many times you can die hard.
Yeah. Anything after the third one. Yeah. Anyway, that's not a tangent at all. Anyway, crazy old man, big killer robot, the guardian of the dragon. And just as you think you're going to get answers, we're going to jump away from them. And go back to the Magma City, which the west side of it is laying in complete ruins. The hab blocks that were miles high have now been smashed to the ground, and there are giant war machines still roaming around, and just as many laying burning where they've been felled. Bodies and rubble, all that remains behind them. Following the warhounds being destroyed, Legio Mortis had pulled back, unwilling to push through the thick terrain. They opted for heavy bombardments instead. The outer habs were no concern. However, the forge was to be captured intact. Thousands of refugees huddling all over the inner forges, along with the machines of Legio Tempestus, who had to withdraw inside to avoid being annihilated. The Knights of Tyrannus were able to repel two more attacks on the gates without loss, until Preceptor Stator Mount took a grievous wound into the chest. To the west, Maximal watched as a host of 500,000 twisted warriors threw themselves at his shielded walls. His defensive servitors washed through wave after wave of screaming monsters, but the onslaught did not falter. He began to worry that his forge may only have a matter of hours left rather than days. Only Kane's forge in the north was not under attack. He was grateful but couldn't understand why. Perhaps the Fabricator General believes he may still be able to win him over. Or maybe he didn't want to risk losing the Astartes supply line and anger the War Master. All he knew was he was relieved to be watching the Stormbirds landing and unloading squadron after squadron of Imperial Fists on the landing fields. And into Chapter 3. I don't know if you've got any end of Chapter 2 thoughts to cover off before we dive straight back in.
Nothing other than, we're ramping up, right? This is the Imperial Fists are involved. Dawn is involved. We're understanding that actually this is the other side of what's happening, and well, the other side of the galaxy. So we're on the flip side of the coin. Actually, there is a response. And they're still confused. They're still all over the place. And suddenly, there's civil war on Mars, the closest planet to Terra, strategically incredibly important, and actually also a massive output for the armaments of the Space Marines. So it's like, shit, this is all going to pot. We need to get a grip on it right now.
Yeah.
And so it's all kicking off.
Definitely. And this is it now, isn't it? If they're not successful now with this evacuation, then game over.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. So, chapter three, Semyon shooed Caxton and Zooch away from his machine, and he fiddled with it as if trying to activate it, but shrugged when nothing happened. Zooch asked what it did, and he laughed, saying that they wouldn't be able to comprehend it. But for the record, it is a gas discharge machine of the perturbation variety. I think I've said that right. Now, see if you can keep up. This is what I've put here. So it creates pulsed electrical field and excitations and thus measures electrophotonic glow, or what the less sophisticated call auras. So I think it zaps you into dust, basically, and looks at your aura, is what I guess.
I mean, yeah.
I don't get it.
Makes sense.
I when I wrote that, it was like, it doesn't make sense, but I think I'll be able to make sense of it. But it's just long words.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah, they don't really get it either. And he tells them it actually took a great deal of convincing to get the subjects of these images to willingly submit to the process. And Zooch asked why. Semyon pointed at one and said, because that is all that remains once the device is activated. And everyone is horrified as he giggles, telling them that these things are necessary to keep the dragon dormant. Dahlia asked him to show her the dragon, and he mocks her, telling her they are walking in the throat of the dragon even now. And Dahlia firmly demands that he take them to the dragon. And Semyon pauses at her commanding tone and looks at her as if he sees her for the first time. Very well, follow me, and I will show you the dragon. He leads them through the tunnels, which again shone with their own light, ignoring any questions they asked him until they came to a wide ledge high up in a glittering cavern of blinding light. It was the largest empty space that anyone had ever seen, and Dahlia felt as if they were at the core of the planet itself. Behold the dragon, he exclaimed as he walked to a wooden lectern, a thick book with a worn leather binding on it. And next to it was a simple inkpot and quill. Dahlia peered over the edge, expecting to see an actual dragon, and looked at the others, who all shrugged. Severin walked to the edge, and Zooch warned her to be careful. This place feels strange. Does anyone else feel this? She said, and Dahlia told her, if the dragon is in here somewhere, it's bound to feel strange. Severin had a confused look on her face as she stared into the distance, and her face twitched as if she was trying to get rid of an unpleasant thought. It's more than that, she said, pointing outward. The angles and perspective is all wrong. The others looked outward and cried out as if her words had removed a blindfold, revealing something new to their frail human senses. Their eyes told them that the wall was impossibly far away, but their brains couldn't mesh the thought with what they were actually seeing. The angles were impossible and the geometry insane. Distance was irrelevant and perspective was a lie. Everything they knew was distorted in a new, horrific reality. Reality, or the cavern, pulsed and the expanded and contracted around them, and they felt as if they were inside some living intelligence with no name, because any name is now meaningless. This being had been around forever and had birthed and destroyed civilizations for just as long. It was everywhere and nowhere, all powerful and at the same time trapped. So Dahlia attempted to snap out of the trance by looking down at her feet, something real that she could focus on until she was overcome with vertigo and fell to her knees, her sanity slowly beginning to unravel. Suddenly a hand took her by the arm and pulled her up, and Zooch stared at her. Don't look at it, he said. Focus on me. She was able to look at him before looking away from the void and bringing her mind back to this reality. Looking around, she saw Caxton laying on the floor in a ball with his eyes closed and white foam sliding from his mouth. Romu was on one knee, clutching his stave as if in prayer, and Severin was exactly where she had been a moment ago, stood on the edge of the ledge. Semyon and his servitor stood near the lectern. I understand, she said. I don't know what the dragon is, but I know where it is. It's the cavern, or at least a sliver of it. Semyon nodded. A tomb and a prison all at once. He beckoned her over to the book and told her to look at it. She moved forward and had the same feeling that she had from the maglev, as if this was her destiny. She looked at the book and saw that the writing was the scribblings of a madman. Nothing made sense and the language was all wrong. As she was about to tell him that she couldn't read it, he leant over the book and took her hands in an iron grip. And as the pages began to turn on their own, she began to beg for it to stop, saying that she didn't want to know. I said the same thing once, but he doesn't care what we want. We have a duty. Look into my eyes and see the dragon's doom. And in one awful moment, Dahlia saw everything. So not quite drinking from a cup, but just as horrifying, I guess.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely.
At least she hasn't like turned in aged a million years in seconds.
No, it's not quite the same as picking the wrong goblet of Christ. Yeah. But it's there. Could happen. Like there's a conversation that is you are.
Mm. Yeah, that's it, isn't it? Well, I wonder if someone else had looked at it, what would have happened? Like if someone had looked at it first. Like, I don't know, Severin went over there. Would she potentially be taking Dahlia's place? Or do you think it would have killed her?
Yeah, I think Dahlia is like a chosen element here. I think it's like a... I think they've... It is like one of those old school quest movies. Like,
yeah.
There is a sacred person that is Dahlia that is only ever... be the one that's going to get there, and everyone else has their skills that are going to help her get there.
Yeah,
but it's only ever going to be that way. A bit like Legend, or what was the other one? Legend. Tom. Sorry, I'm getting off a tangent.
That's right.
there were two in the 80s that were very similar to this. Legend with Tom Cruise and another one.
I'm sure. As soon as
Princess Bride. There you go. Yeah. Anyway, doesn't matter.
There we go. I'm glad. I was going to say, if you think of it as we go along, just shout it out.
Yeah.
Cool. And again, just as it's getting interesting, we're going to leave them and go back to the Imperial forces. They're now fighting all over Mars. Sigismund landed at Mundus Oculum with 13 companies of the Saturnine. Hoplites surrounding the forge of Maximal, initially making good progress, cutting through the Dark Mechanicum's rear defences until the Scutari began to attack from the flanks and hundreds died in every clash. Horrified at the twisted machinery, the Imperials died in their droves and were on the brink of collapse until a brigade of super heavy tanks burst through to reinforce them. Smashing a path through the enemy, the oversized war machines gave the ground troops a route through to attempt to break the siege. While Sigismund and his fist secured supplies at the Forge of Cain, Captain Camber Diaz was less welcome at the Forge of Mundus Oculum. Smashing their way through into Crom's production facilities, they truly had the element of surprise, as hundreds of warriors in golden plate and over 15,000 Imperial soldiers stormed his defences and spread out, seizing various factories. With a secure drop site, they immediately began relieving Crom of his wares. Giant land carriers and servitors began pouring into the forge, and as suddenly as the Astartes arrived, the inner defences sprang to life. A host of screeching battle robots attacked, burning through the Imperial invaders. Alongside those, a tank of blank-faced automatons fought with a deadly force, slowing and then stopping the advance of the Imperial fists. Giving the mortal defenders a chance to regroup and attack, only the immortal might of the Astartes prevented them from being overwhelmed in the initial counterattack. Soldiers fought and died as the loaders rushed forwards to evacuate as many suits of armour as they could from the burning factories. Camber Diaz knew that the death of the Imperial forces was a small price to pay. Terror would stand or fall based on what he would do there today. It's going to jump about a bit now. So going back to Dahlia, the cavern faded from view. She's still in the grip of Semyon, and Dahlia became aware of a new world where she stood high on the desert dunes, looking over a wide river valley, and felt an intense heat from the sun beating down on her. And Semyon asked if she knew where she was, and she said, "This must be old Earth before unification." Semyon agreed and told her it was long before that, and the tribes of men had no idea of anything beyond their planet. She pointed at the city in the distance and asked where she was. And again, he told her off and said, "You're still inside the cavern. This is all in your mind. But for argument's sake, we're in Libya. The city is called Serene, and they are sometime between the 11th and 12th century. A long time by anyone's reckoning, except maybe his." And Dahlia asked who he was talking about, and Semyon said, "You will see shortly." From the city in the distance, a long procession of women wearing white robes marched out into the desert. Dahlia asked who they are as the women moved towards a large crater in the ground. "These are the handmaidens of the king's daughter, and they are taking her to her death. A dragon found its way here after a war with its own kind and sought refuge in order to regain its strength. It has slain all the knights in the city, and now they have to feed it a beautiful maiden every day as a sacrifice, as it grows stronger on their fear, and the king's daughter is the last maiden left." Dahlia's immediate instinct is to help, but Semyon tells her it's too late and pointed to the distance, where a knight in golden armor rode a black charger towards the women, carrying a silver lance with red and white banner depicting a soaring eagle grasping a bolt of lightning. "Who is that?" Dahlia asks. "At the moment, he is a soldier of the Emperor Diocletian, one of high honor who's just passing through Libya to rejoin his men." The knight overtook the procession of women straight to the mouth of the scar in the ground, and as he halted, he readied his shield, and a dragon burst out of the cave. This is very fantasy, isn't it?
It's very much old world. It's very much, Crusades, Knights of the Old World. Mm. Absolutely. To the point where you start listening to it, you go, "What's this?
Yeah.
What?"
It just feels really odd, doesn't it? Like, out of place. Not what I was expecting. An actual dragon.
It feels like actual prehistory myths and legends that they're trying to make real.
Yeah.
And I know, as we get into it, that they will. They know it is analogy. It's not necessarily real, as per, like, you know, St. George and the dragon.
Yeah.
Like we know, spoiler alert for everyone out there, that there are no real dragons. But
take that back.
I'm sorry. Sorry. That's my personal belief. But they are analogies for, you know, other things. That's it. Whereas here we're listening to it, and like, as the story is being told, it is being relayed as real. As the reader, we decide whether or not we believe it to be actually what's happening or analogy. And then, as said, you get the reliable, whether or not the person that's saying it's a reliable source, like in other bits there, you know, the Joker, are they a reliable source of what's actually happening whilst you're seeing it through their eyes, or is it entirely different? And like here, is this knight charging down a dragon? Is it a dragon? No, we don't know. We don't. We have to assume what we read.
Yeah. What we see is what we get at the minute.
Indeed. Yeah. Sorry, I went a bit deep there.
That's cool. No, that's fine. That's what we like doing. That. That's, I think that's part of the charm of what we've been doing for probably about 100 hours now.
Yeah, fair few, yeah.
Anyway, so dragon burst out of the ground. The warrior leapt and struck his lance against the dragon, but his lance shattered against its armoured scales. It struck back with its talons, shredding his armour open on his legs, spilling his blood onto the sand. They exchanged blows until the dragon got so angry that it shot lightning from its eyes, knocking the soldier's helmet off. Dahlia noticed that as they fought, the dragon always protected a single spot under its right wing and started willing the knight to strike it there. As if he heard her, he stabbed the beast in its weak spot. And as the eyes dimmed, it let go of the knight and it fell to the ground. It was now helpless but not dead, so the knight took his banner, tied it around his neck, As the crowds from the city began to cheer for him, he raised his hand to silence them. He had such a powerful aura that everyone who could see him fell silent. The dragon is defeated, but it is beyond my power to destroy it, so I will drag it from this place and bind it deep in the darkness where it will remain until the end of time. And with that, he rode off, dragging the beast behind him. The world froze around them, and Dalia and Semyon continued talking about how... The world froze around them, and Dalia and Semyon continued talking. They talked about how this is all the dragon can remember from that day. He listens to its angry cries and writes down everything it says in this book, such as things like the Emperor slaying the Dragon of Mars, the grand lie of the Red Planet, the truth would shake the galaxy. But what is the truth but a movement target anyway? Dalia was still amazed and said, so that man was the Emperor. And Semyon said, yes, he brought the dragon to Mars and bound it beneath the Noctis Labyrinthus. He sees things that we cannot. He sees the future and he guides us all to it, pushing humanity from nothing to mastering science, all by his design, working on one glorious union where the future he forges and the forges of Mars will perceive him as the divinity for who they would wait for centuries. He orchestrated the evolution of the Mechanicum as he knew that one day he would need a mighty organization to serve him. The dragon's dreams produced the first machines of the priests of Mars. Without the dragon, there would be no Mechanicum. And without the Mechanicum, the Emperor's dreams of a united galaxy would have ended. Dalia couldn't comprehend the scale of planning that it took to orchestrate this destiny of so many by one man. All she knew that is if it was discovered, it would destroy the Mechanicum. And Semyon told her that the Imperium would crumble too, as neither could exist without the other. The truth of this would cause a war worse than what is already happening on Mars. And Semyon tells her that the dragon has been bound by chains greater than he could make, and tells her it's our job to prevent the dragon's lost children from ever finding this place. And with that, the desert fades away and the cavern comes back. And Dalia says, what do you mean we? I'm not a guardian. And he says to her, why do you think that every step you've taken has brought you here? And has reached out and takes her arms again. She tried to pull away, but couldn't, and looked into his eyes. And he said, I'm sorry, but my time has ended. You must fulfill your destiny as the next guardian of the dragon. The heat from Semyon's hands moved over to Dalia's body, and her body regenerated itself, every dead cell coming back to life. She was filled with a sliver of power and all knowledge that had been passed down from guardian to guardian. As her knowledge increased, her anger towards the Emperor melted, as now she saw the ultimate horrific fate of humanity without his guidance. She saw his pitiless drive to guide his race down the narrow path of survival. She felt her old self fade away and a new self be born. And when the roaring power within completed its work, she discovered she was still herself, but also much more. Semyon let go of her and said goodbye and dissolved into a fine golden dust as he faded. And as he went, so did the ancient servitor he arrived with, leaving only his robe behind. She turned and saw Severin looking at her, who had tears rolling down her face. And Severin said, you brought me the dragon, Dalia, but I wish you hadn't. It's a mercy that we can't usually see these terrible things that hide in the darkness. If you could see the things that I see now, you would do the same. And Severin stepped over the ledge. And that's the end of chapter 3. What happens? What?
Yeah, right. I mean, there's a lot of, like, those watching it back rather than listening back will see my reactions to key moments.
Okay, we knew Dalia was heading down here for something. A guardian of the dragon. What is it? How has he What is he buried under Mars to orchestrate all this? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
So I think part of it right now is that, well, right now, and it's not unveiled, like, I don't know far enough. I've read some stuff, but like, you could Google it. That's fine.
Right.
What is the Dragon of Mars? And there's lots of theories in the lore that would talk about it. But there's clues, and there's bits that, you know, they're like, you know, about followers and who could find it, yada yada. One of the big things they always talk about is that the Dragon of Mars could be Necron.
Oh wow.
Yeah, could be. That's not confirmed. That's one of the theories. There's multiple different bits and pieces, and ultimately there's a lot, you know, with the Emperor use it as a political bargaining chip to make sure that Mars followed. Is it something in there that's actually benign, something that doesn't matter at all? Again, could be the case. However, this story, the Mechanicum that we're reading, indicates that no, that isn't the case. There is a power there. There is something that is strong enough that requires guardianship. Guardianship. It requires guardianship that requires someone to actually look after it, and thus feeding back into it being some kind of construct, which would also, you know, I think GW have done it on purpose. It's something that could be Necron, but also could not be. It could be anything at all. It could be Dark Mechanicum. It could be something that is entirely biological. The fact is that all we know is that the Emperor has put it in its place, has shut it down via some means, and it has remained shut down via his means, and that there is a required stewardship of that entity that requires some source of faith. Because the person that is looking after it has to have faith in some form or another. So it's quite interesting in that regard. Like, will we ever know? Don't know. Will they uncover it? Maybe. Are we there yet? No, we're very early on. Normally I would say spoiler alert, but actually I've not listened ahead enough to know whether or not this is something that happened.
Oh wow, well that's cool. Something we'll have to figure out. To get, I mean, bloody hell! Like, just as you think we're going to get answers, I know the book's not finished just yet.
True.
But just as you think you're going to get answers, more questions.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Yeah.
And Severine's just killed herself.
This is true. Yeah. Yeah, a very subtle point in the story. In the arc. Yeah, she has stopped herself.
She was a bit emotional though, all through this, wasn't she? Like we were saying before, everyone's played a part. I don't really know what part she played other than being a bit annoying.
I think she was in there to make a punctuation point. To make it seem like that. It was very, very important.
Yeah.
So, like, she wasn't important enough early on.
Yeah.
Where we had the assassin needing to find her way and kill what's her chops. Don't remember. But right now, it was like, right, we need to punctuate the point that this is a very, very important moment, and it's going to fry a lot of people's heads. So. Someone's going to go off the edge.
Well, bad luck. Yeah, fair enough. I suppose, yeah. Just showing Dahlia sort of what the magnitude of what they've stumbled upon, I guess.
To really
hammer home. Oh, well, we thought we might get it done in this part, but we're going to have to do one more. Otherwise,
we'll be here
forever.
We're very close to the end.
Yeah, there's only 3 chapters left. And this is officially now the longest book It's just like we've said a few times now. It's just so different, isn't
what
it?
What have we got next?
Next, after this book, we'll be going into Tales of Heresy. So, lots of short stories.
Loads of quick stuff then. Yeah. So, yeah, stick with us.
Yeah.
We will get there.
Yeah. And, I've read the first couple of pages of it, so I'm actually now beyond where I've been before. Ooh. I've read Mechanicum 2.5 times now onto a new book, but we've still got to finish what will now be part 7.
We've got the very end, which we know is going to be, I was going to say, both of us know now, 3 times over, it's going to be good. there's, you know, it is the conclusion, the dramatic conclusion, including a lot of Legio activity,
yep.
As well as the culmination of what we see under the Dark Labyrinth, the Noctis Labyrinthus, and also the Schism of Mars in full flux. So the good guys versus the bad guys, and how that is probably going to impact the rest of the rest of the story. And as John has now flashed up the where to find us, now to support us, it's everywhere where you can search Iron and Ceramite. That be Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, all of your good podcast services, Spotify, Apple, and everywhere else. Twitch, we're there occasionally. Mm. Patreon, you can go and pledge. Might buy us a paint of wash. God knows I need it. Element Games, you're going to be buying stuff anyway if you're listening to us, to follow the link, add our code, gives us a bit of a kickback. It is going to go into the channel. We're creeping up to a point where we might actually be able to buy something that improves the channel. Could be mics, could be, well, it's not going to be chapter approved because we've already got that, but it could be anything else. And when we do get it, we'll let you know.
Yeah.
And then combat cards, I'm loath to say it. You can join if you want to. A few of us play it. Me and Glenn primarily. But that's about the gist of it. Anyway, if you want to join, you want to follow, search Iron and Ceramite anywhere you might search something, and we'll be there.
Cool. Brilliant. See you on the next episode and the final installment of Mechanicum.
Absolutely.
As always, we would like to thank you for listening to our Iron and Ceramite podcast. If you liked us, then you can also find us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and any other good podcast services. Just remember, in the grim darkness of the far future, there is only war.